You're listening to Idaho Matters. I'm Samantha Wright, filling in for Jim Agudat. In the last 500 years, more than 1,000 animals and plants have gone extinct. Scientists say we're in Earth's sixth mass extinction. Many species, such as the passenger pigeon, can no longer be found on our planet. More are on the brink of going extinct every single day. Two researchers wanted to know what lessons could be learned from past extinctions and from some of the success stories that could be applied to animals that are in trouble right now. They've published a set of essays looking at specific animals under threat of extinction in the journal Environmental History, and the essays are titled Extinction and Its Interventions in the Americas. Joining us now is Emily Wakeel, the Professor of History and Director of Environmental Studies at Boise State University. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Samantha. Great to be with you.
Yeah. Okay. I want to start off with a success story. And one of the stories that's in this set of essays, it's the vicuna?
Yeah, the vicuña. This is one of my favorite stories. And everybody knows a llama, but few people know that the llama has wild cousins. And one of the best examples of a wild cousin is the vicuña, which is an animal so cute Walt Disney couldn't have designed it himself, right? Picture the llama's cuter younger sister that's fluffier and fuzzier. And softer, and the vicuña used to run in herds a million strong across South America. But after the Spanish arrived and brought their own sheep and pigs and cows with them, the vicuña habitat was encroached upon, and the numbers got smaller and smaller. And then after independence, vicuña wool really hit the global market, and people realized that the vicuña had a wool that was softer than anything that had ever been milled, and it became the luxury fabric sought at by royalty and by celebrities. And so much so that this fabric by the 1950s and 1960s was sort of a status symbol that was more subtle than a mink coat, but also more extravagant because it cost more than five times the price of a cashmere sweater. And so you could find vicuña wool on Nat King Cole or in the blankets of the Kennedy White House. But in the wild, the animal was very quickly going extinct because rather than shear the animal like you would a sheep, the animals were being poached and were being killed and then their wool taken off of them. So much so that from a peak of probably 2 million animals in the 16th century, by the 1960s, there were fewer than 6,000 of them in the wild.
Wow. Wow. And that's what we see on Nat King Cole when he's singing his classic songs, right, is vicuña wool.
That's right. That's right.
Okay, so they're in trouble in the 30s and 40s. Well, how were they saved?
So this is where the history gets really interesting because a group of Peruvians, some aristocrats, some politicians, and a lot of scientists got together and decided it would be a tragedy of unspeakable proportions to let the animal go extinct. And so they intervened with a set of really pretty obvious by today's standards interventions. They set up a reserve in the habitat where the animals lived. They stopped poaching by banning international trade. And they also sponsored a campaign to save the vicuña. And very quickly, by setting aside this piece of land, this reserve for the animals, the population increased. They trained rangers to guard this reserve. And within a decade, the opposite problem was a bit of a challenge, was that the population within the reserve was overstripping both the water and the grazing availability of that spot. And so the success story brought with it additional challenges, what to do about the animals that were now starving to death and that were being wasted in this landscape. And so the reserves expanded, and another set of interventions on different properties from Ecuador and Chile and other parts of the Andes have made it so that there's a population well over 300,000 wild vicuñas in the world today.
Wow. And I think you called all that success, too much success, a good example of the unpredictability of intervention, which I think is fascinating because humans can try to take steps to try and save animals, but there's no guarantee that you're going to know exactly how it's going to turn out.
That's exactly right. And so one of the things that Herman Vergara, who was my collaborator in editing this collection, and I wanted to point out was that there's a lot of nuance that we can learn about the specific places in the past where intervention has actually worked. And another example that we give in this forum is a comparison between the Cuban crocodile and the American alligator, both of which were under threat of extinction by the 1950s, largely in a similar story to the vicuñas for the products that could be produced from the animal skins. But we know the Cuban situation and the American situation politically and socially was really distinct. And yet both societies intervened with policies that were put into place before the animals went extinct. And so in the Cuban case, Fidel Castro helped set up in the Zapata Swamp a farm that had hatcheries that protected this species of Cuban crocodile. And in the American situation, scientists were able to put in place forward-looking policies in conjunction with the Endangered Species Act that allowed the alligator to be protected, even though there weren't really accurate population figures of how many animals were left. But in both cases, those interventions were able to grow the population and bring them back from what seemed like a sure trajectory of extinction.
Well, and I think that's a good example of not just one solution to the extinction problem, right?
That's exactly right. And we look at the hemisphere of the Americas, really looking at charismatic vertebrate species that have had these near tragedies and often been brought back from the brink. And one of the lessons here that I think is so important is that when we lose an animal, we don't just lose that animal. We lose part of the human past, because the parts of human life that become intertwined with animal species, such as the passenger pigeon, also go away, right? Passenger pigeons were sold for food at markets in Chicago. Mm-hmm. And when that animal no longer exists, that piece of the human past is also extinct.
Wow. We're speaking with Emily Wakehill, professor of history and director of environmental studies at Boise State University, about a set of essays she published in the journal Environmental History titled Extinction and Its Interventions in the Americas. You talked about the hemisphere. We should, you say, think about the hemisphere and not just the nation. Think sort of like an animal would when you're working on solutions to extinction, because animals aren't necessarily going to follow the lines on a map.
That's exactly right. So another example we give in this forum is about the bears in California. And California, in this case, goes into Mexico, but includes the Southern California ecosystem that we know. And this is a demonstration of a trend that is not always ending in extinction, but that scientists have called faunal downgrading or faunal downsizing, which means that sort of big predators are getting smaller and smaller as they're faced with pressures from human populations. And so the historian and the scientist that worked on this piece call it the three bear shuffle in Southern California, where the short-faced bear was a grizzly of enormous proportions, right? It was more than 12 feet tall, and it was this enormous bear that lived in Southern California 15,000 years ago. And the grizzly at that time did not inhabit the same space because the short-faced bear was so ferocious. But once the short-faced bear bear went extinct, the grizzly and the black bear moved into Southern California. And this shuffle took place in the face of a really dynamic change in human populations as well. And so understanding the way that faunal downsizing or downgrading has taken place also gives us insight into transitions such as the Spanish occupation or the Mexican colonization of what we know today as California.
All right. We've got about a minute left. You know, we get a lot of these doom and gloom predictions about animals going extinct. It's very depressing. But I love how you're trying to counter that with success stories and then some solutions from history.
That's right. And it is impossible to overplay the really tragedy of tremendous proportions that the extinction crisis is. However, when we put different disciplines together, we can also see that there is enormous hope for intervening in ways that are meaningful for other species that we share the planet with. And so there's a solution-based possibility to looking at different scales and to understanding really policy-based and social interventions that make an enormous difference for protecting the habitats of a wide range of species.
Oh, that's great. We've been speaking with Emily Wakeel, Professor of History and Director of Environmental Studies at Boise State University, about a set of essays she published in the journal Environmental History titled Extinction and Its Interventions in the Americas. Emily, thanks for coming back on the show.
Glad to. Thanks, Samantha.
I'm Samantha Wright, filling in for Jim Agudat. You're listening to Idaho Matters.